Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-host
Ishmir Stinger.
I'll do the live countdown.
Do the countdown.
Okay.
Welcome to episode 138. I am Ishmir Stinger, and your hosts today are Dan Q.
The world may or may not come to an end.
Makalua.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the Mayans would argue with you about that one.
Lisa Bang.
Hi there.
And the Mian Team.
You're right to worry, regardless of year.
Because Phil's coming for you with a warm nuke.
That's happiness. I'm just trying to make your empire more happy.
Happiness is a warm thermonuclear weapon?
Apparently.
Yeah, yeah. You reduce population, less crowding, more happiness. It feels so nice. The troll face feels so nice, too. Like, once you put it on, it's just it's so hard to get it off. You know, once it hits the lips, you know, so good, so good.
It's been more than a month since we have recorded, and if we're a little bit rusty, well, too bad, so sad. We have a number of topics to get to, especially since it's been more than a month since we recorded. There was quite a few things that have been announced.
That's later, Mackie. Hold on a moment.
Well, we're getting a little too excited there.
Calm down to no alphas and Atari, too.
So we know that Mackie has had at least one cup of caffeine at this point. There was a Civilization 5 patch released just before Christmas in 2011. Whoa, yeah, I mean, this is, I couldn't categorize this as news because it was last year, but this patch is...
are you saying this patch is so last year?
Yes. It was a multiplayer improvement patch, primarily. Significant improvements to general multiplayer stability. Multiplayer now using the same AI move caching as single player, improving turn time significantly. I'm reading right from the patch notes. Lobby improvements now displaying game details in the lobby list, so players in each game, map size, map type, downloadable content required or not. Host can now kick players from the staging room when loading a save, and if a player cannot return to a game, the game can now be continued by the rest of the players. Thank you, thank you.
No, I'm going to drop and scroll you.
I think that's more of an issue in competitive MP than cooperative MP, but who's to say? There were additional out-of-sync issues found and corrected. Not to say that there aren't out-of-sync issues still. But I also, actually, for the most part, I enjoyed the exploit notes. Corrected an exploit that allowed players on the same team to trade cities back and forth to auto-heal it.
What? Who does that? I'm just...
Wow. Never be able to take a city. Never.
Oh, man, the time to play on formal teams in MP is past. No. You could also trade cities back and forth on a team to generate endless city strikes. Yes. And then also corrected an exploit that allowed a player to lag the user interface to gain multiple free techs. Oh, no.
Jeez, how many Civ games in a row can we go with this particular bug? I seem to recall this in Civ 4 as well.
It's tradition, Phil, tradition.
Oh, I see.
User interface change load game save sorting to be last modified by default. I appreciate that convenience. And then there's a list of bugs, too, but I'm just going to highlight. When a unit is destroyed that is carrying another unit, make sure to kill both. Missiles sometimes lingered. You have to let it linger.
No cranberries.
A little bit too close to a real-life problem with the missile lingering.
Yeah, you shoot down a nuclear sub, and you've still got missiles, like, on the bottom of the ocean.
Good time.
But this is about gameplay, not realism, is he? Come on. Phantoms in this in the thread on 2K asks, will this patch be awesome or just meh? And I honestly think the answer is somewhere in between the two. I'm going to go with very good. 2K Greg said that, I know that the change list is shorter than many of our previous patches, but if you try out the multiplayer, you'll hopefully see the magnitude of some of those changes is pretty large. And yes, this is more quality over quantity. Not to say that the quantity patches we had before didn't have quality, but we're focusing on some rather large multiplayer issues that had not been addressed before. I mean, someone said, I'm happy for the multiplayer community. They've been horrendously neglected. Single player has gotten a lot more so far. Of course, the game shouldn't need this much patching in the first place. He also says, that was BRX, BRX, but that's a tangent. several people have reported that the game has improved in terms of speed. 4 to 5 hour games without freezing, not as many out of sync, not as much lag in between turns. One person reported that loading a save game resulted in a please wait issue that was never resolved, but it seems that that is specifically limited to manual saves, but the autosave problem does not have that issue.
Silence lapping for multiplayer. If it works, then the patch was a success. If it doesn't, then that was a whole lot of nothing.
It's good to see them at least attempting to address it after so long, so that's a step in the right direction, absolutely.
XCOM!
Yay!
I don't think Dan's ever played it, people, so this is why he's not all glee about it like those of us who have played it.
This is correct.
Those of us who've only played Terror from the Deep when they were like 10 or 11, I mean, there's some bitter memories there, but nevertheless, certainly this is an interesting release to come.
I'm checking to see if my passport is still valid so I can go to Canada and tie Dan to a chair and make him play XCOM, because it is seriously that important of a game.
Mackie, tag team Izzy out and come do that.
No, I'm not tying you to a chair.
Yeah, she gets to use the taser. That's her role.
You will do this terror mission over Canada and like it.
Actually, you couldn't ignore those. Canada was one of the funding nations.
That's right. Wait, let's check. Is Ottawa on the map? That would be funny. I can hear the glare of Dan's silence through here.
Okay, so now here's the thing. Dan is not the only person that's going to be like, XCOM, what? Or will think of that terrible game that, who is it, 2K is producing? So there's a lot of
first shooter. Go.
Yes, this is XCOM Enemy Within, Enemy Unknown, not XCOM.
This is the cool XCOM that's the strategy one, not the pew-pew shooter. Not that I have any fan shooters, but not
doesn't even
XCOM.
Up. So here's the deal. Way back in the before times of 1993, a unknown game studio in Great Britain called Mythos Games, under Microprose, this was back when Microprose was a publisher, and for those of you who know your Civilization history, this was back when Sid Meier was one of the managing partners of Microprose before things got weird there. So these guys produced a game called UFO Enemy Unknown, but only released it under that title in the European market. It was released as XCOM UFO Defense in the United States and Japan, and later it was ported to the Sony PlayStation as XCOM Enemy Unknown. XCOM Enemy Unknown is the title that the new Firaxis game is using, and there's also a first-person shooter betrayal of the franchise being produced by 2K, who has the same corporate owner as Firaxis, called XCOM. So you have to say a lot of words to tell people what game you're talking about when you say XCOM. It's never clear. So this is critics and fans to be one of the greatest games ever made. A top 10 list of greatest video games that does not include XCOM is written incorrectly. It was an innovative, real-time, and turn-based strategy game hybrid. The thing that was unusual about it was that the overall strategic part was the real-time portion, and the close-in tactical squad combat was the turn-based portion. So the premise of this game is pretty basic. The whole Roswell alien abduction, cattle mutilation, little gray men with triangular heads and big black eyes. All of that is true, and there really is a government cover-up. But you're not one of the conspiracy theorists. You're the government cover-up in this game. You attempt to shoot down alien UFOs to recover the wreckage and steal their technology, reverse engineer it so that you can equip a squad to eventually stymie the alien threat to Earth.
There's a lot of management going on in the real-time base part, because you're having to manage the research, you're having to manage your finances at all the bases. If you don't do well on the missions, you can have funding countries drop out. And if I think it was usually like U.S. and Japan and usually France were usually big funders. And if you have one of them drop out, it's like, ah, crap, where am I getting the money to pay for all this next month?
For those of you who are interested, you can still get this game. It's available on Steam, as are all of its sequels, which we're really not going to talk about because they were kind of blatant money grabs. What do you think, Megan? I'm cautiously optimistic about Firaxis' version of XCOM in
the
end.
The few screenshots that have come out don't look too bad. And, you know, that interview you're talking about where they said the guys on the team were talking about it, they get it. That's heartening right there. They actually get why it was fun. So they're, you know, that I don't think they would try to modernize it too much.
However, I am remaining in the cautious optimism camp because, well, Civ 5.
Yeah, and also remakes in general.
Let's hope. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. All of them. Let's see. Cross. Okay. Got my whole hands crossed. I don't think I can cross my toes, too.
I can cross the big toe and the one immediately next to it, so I'll do that.
Wow.
Crossing something else right now. That would be my arms. Anyway.
That's exactly what I thought you meant.
Yeah, very quiet. Did the ethereal commander mind control him?
Yeah, no, he's just panicking at the size of the alien. That is the next topic, because there is no good segue from XCOM to Civ 4, but that's where we're headed next. You know, back towards the original intention of podcast. No, but XCOM is awesome, so we had
we
to spend
an
XCOM time on
cast.
Yes.
All right, we want to segue fine. From outer space to inner space. I don't know.
That was actually pretty good.
It is started by Marigold Rand, moving on to Civ 4, Strategy and Tips. And it's titled, Money Does Grow on Trees, How to Convert Farce into Lots and Lots of Gold. Now, the topic of this thread is that building wealth is one hammer equals one gold and not very efficient. That's true, but it isn't, depending on what you're doing and what your alternatives are. That can actually be a good investment. In fact, it can be your best investment. But Marigold Rand offers us some alternatives that do still work in Patch 3.19, such as getting math for the 50% better chops from the forests, organized religion for building wonders, industrious for building wonders, wonder resources, and essentially you're chopping your trees into wonders or putting hammers into wonders at a 100% bonus, 150% bonus, 175% bonus, however much you can get, and then deliberately failing the wonder so you get that converted into gold. Now, he does run marathons, so that does make this a little bit more effective than it would be on normal speed, but it still can be useful on normal speed to deliberately fail wonders. And unfortunately, they bugged overflow in 3.19, so you can't do that anymore for gold. But certainly investing into things can be worth your time. And that's also true for things like Moai statues. Build those in multiple cities and then finally finish them if you have stone, and you can get a lot of gold with that. And unlike some of the world wonders, you can control precisely when you get the gold. And
Hermitage is a good one if you have marble.
Yes. A little bit later, but also good, yes. Functionally, this lets you convert hammers to gold at a more efficient rate at the expense of some present value. Now, usually, though, that's going to be worth it unless you're really strapped. And also, these things are often available before you have currency, which is a very huge lift. If you're having trouble in the early game or spamming out cities and expanding really hard, these kinds of tactics can get you the gold you need, deficit research to key technologies like currency or, you know, like monarchy or like code of laws. I would go currency, by the way, for the most of the time. That's one of the most useful early texts. But anyway, It's certainly a strategy to keep in mind if you're still running Civ 4 like some of us and want to get some extra gold in the early goings.
I think the OP for that thread mostly plays on Marathon. I don't have the patience for that, but I understand that the conversion rate for chopping is IMBA on Marathon, and it's a much more powerful strategy at that game speed.
I thought the Marathon hammers scaled properly. 90 hammers on Marathon, 30 hammers on Standard. The reason Marathon gets an advantage in this is the same reason Marathon gets an advantage in absolutely everything. Unit movement doesn't scale the way along with the turns. So units functionally move at 3 times the speed per turn, or I guess per year, I should say, that they would on normal. So you can move a worker onto a forest tile and chop it, and you're spending less turns or a smaller percentage of your turns moving relative to making the improvement, which the improvement scales but the movement doesn't. So chopping in general is going to be stronger in Marathon because of that.
Oh,
but
I know
this thing is normal too.
It's the early chops that the other thing that doesn't scale on Marathon is the cost of units. Most things are multiplied by 3.
Yes.
The cost of units is only multiplied by 2. So what I was thinking of as far as chops being IMBA was chopping into workers and settlers for your opening build order. On Marathon, if you've got a lot of forests, sometimes the optimal opening is worker, settler, if you can research bronze working in time to come out with your first worker.
It's true, although you might want some commerce, too, depending on your difficulty level. If you're, like, by commerce, I mean being able to settle along a coastline or long river, something that immediately gives you a trade network so that your second city actually improves your resource rate as opposed to hindering it. It's situational, but, yeah, that can really be the best opening sometimes because of the unit cost and chopping benefits you get on Marathon. It's definitely a different game, you know, when you're playing it on Marathon versus normal. You really can't compare games played on one speed to games played on the other. I mean, the fundamental theory of gameplay is the same. You're still looking at returns on the choices you make and how quickly you get at them, how important they are, whatever. But it's different. It plays out very differently because of the movement speed and everything. So,
and it's
much
pronounced on Marathon.
Windows. Yes, by far. Although quick is also very, very pronounced compared to the other speeds, especially with its culture scaling. Quick can be a little on the ridiculous side in a bad way.
In going through this thread, the thread was hijacked on a few occasions, such as the patch focuses and outcomes between 3.17 and 3.19 for Beyond the Sword, on StarCraft and StarCraft II, and of course, whether or not to whip Granaries apparently also came up in this thread. But
I may or may not have been responsible for a few of these things.
That is an interesting note. You used to be able to convert trees into gold in another way prior to patch 3.something. I think it was 3.19 is the one that fixed it.
It's 3.19 that bugged overflow.
Yeah, if you could get a whole bunch of overflow into whatever you were building, and I think it was if the amount of overflow you had was more than twice the hammer cost of what you were building, then the remainder would be converted into gold. And there were a number of ways to exploit this, including multiple chops ending on the same turn.
The overflow was capped at the cost of the thing that was last built. And so in the case of protective walls in particular, in Geez Viewed Stone, it was insane. What people would do is they would have the walls near completion and whip them, and then make sure that, like, you know, somewhere between 3 and 5 chops finished simultaneously, and you could throw down like 300 gold plus on normal speed that way on occasion. And, you don't need me to tell you that that's and you get a couple of those, and it's like you've got a great merchant trade mission, and all of a sudden you're getting all your early tax much sooner. That's why protective, while overflow is still around, was actually not a bad trade at all. It was actually fairly solid if you took advantage of the overflow. For whatever reason, though, they took that away without helping protective.
It's now universally reviled for the most part as the worst trait, but back when you could do that, the people who like to exploit things like that would sometimes say it was the best one. So that was a pretty hard nerf.
That's useless. Isn't always war, but for the most part, it is a terrible trait, sadly.
Now, Mario Goldran, who started the thread, at one point said, except for the GW and Pyramid, so I guess he's talking about the Great Wall there,
yeah,
it might be a better idea not to build any wonder at all and instead rely on the thousands of fail gold you get instead. The gold is more useful because it allows you to get to the important texts like liberalism faster. And then there was a discussion about, in relation to difficulty levels, specifically deity, because I know that we've already talked about the difference between, you know, standard and quick and marathon speeds. And Obsolete, past guest on the show as well, says that he doesn't know any deity players that thinks it's better to go after liberalism without building wonders like the Great Library, National Epic, not a world wonder, but a national wonder, Parthenon, etc. But then Mario Gold Rand says, the issue is this. Is the Great Library better, or is it however many hammers equals fail gold you can get from the Great Library better? Would you rather have that or lots and lots of instantaneous gold at a time when you're racing for liberalism? Great person points and wonder span really only begin to kick in near the end of the game. The gold comes immediately and at a critical time, too.
The great people points. I think they're both wrong, honestly.
Yeah, on deity and sometimes even immortal, you need those great scientists to even make it to liberalism.
Yes.
Because education, and they bulb into education, so.
Although Great Library can be a trap, especially if you are not industrious and don't have marble. In that case, it becomes a very expensive investment, and you can get it, but it starts to become a thing where it may actually slow you down to live instead of speed you up because you're diverting your beakers and your hammers so heavily into the wonder that then takes longer to pay back its returns. And you also, since you don't have marble, getting National Epic is more difficult at this time frame, so again, you're looking at much later paybacks on that tech path than you would have otherwise, and that does factor into lib times. And I've read a lot of forum threads over the years, and it is anything but universal at the deity level that you always want to be finishing, say, Great Library or really any of the wonders, although Great Lighthouse is, when Great Lighthouse is useful, almost anyone would tell you to get it. But as that wonder aside, you're not going to find any consensus at the deity level that any one wonder is super important. And I have seen some people put up tremendously impressive tech times without so much as touching Great Library on deity. Players far better than I am that will see rifles at like 700 AD who didn't bother with it. So it is situation, trait, and, you know, whatever specific, whether or not you want to finish these wonders. But you probably wouldn't build a Great Library for fail gold if you didn't have marble. And, yeah, it's probably worth building at that point for the great person points.
This is how that thread got hijacked, though. The point is that some of the wonders are actually useful to build instead of just getting fail gold from them.
Yeah,
and there's a whole discussion that you can have for each individual wonder.
At one point, also in the thread, Koanda says that the advantage of forests is that they let you generate a large burst of production in a short time. So often you save them until there is a time-limited opportunity to do something uniquely valuable with that production, quote-unquote, and I would say, actually, in my case, that is not true. I typically do not save them unless they happen to be, you know, say, tundra forests, for example. But Koanda further says that Marigold Rand's point is that if you can get 2.5 gold per hammer until a specific wonder is built, chopping forests can be just a uniquely valuable, time-sensitive opportunity. He's not saying fail gold isn't worth getting with ordinary hammers. He's saying that it can be worth chopping down forests to get it, which isn't true for all production.
That's an entirely different issue. I'm worried that we digress from the point of the thread a little bit. Yeah, chopping early versus later. Most of the time you want to chop early, assuming you have anything remotely valuable to build, because it's another one of those present value things. You know, you invest those hammers now, they go into something that starts benefiting your empire sooner, and you get more total benefit than if you save the forests. And, you know, later in the game, you do have the option to build lumber mills, and you do get the health from the forests, but usually that's not enough to offset alternative options that crop up in the later game when you factor the earlier benefits of the chopping. And in multiplayer scenarios, you also have very strong tactical reasons for chopping forests that you don't get your butt kicked because people are using your own defensive terrain against you to spork your cities. So there's a lot of reasons to chop forests, and usually they go into workers and settlers fairly early, or key early buildings rather than being held off. Because you chop into a granary or you chop a library, you know, the very strong early economic buildings or in some cases military, either of those things are going to be huge, huge benefits in the early goings and will probably pay back more dividends than you could possibly get by saving forests.
Yeah, you're right in that this was a bit of a tangent point, but yes, the thread is about chopping forests to get lots of gold from fail cash, so it was just...
That's true.
Just kind of an extension of just looking at the slightly bigger picture.
Speaking of ways to maximize the benefit you get from your workers, our next topic is...
Good enough. Continue on.
Pointing out a way that you can maximize your benefit from your workers by microing them. Workers have two movement, so if you need to move them to improve a tile that is two or a multiple of two spaces away, then that would consume their entire turn with nothing but movement. He points out that you can instead move them one tile, begin building a road, cancel it, and then on the next turn move one tile and start the intended improvement. This takes the exact same number of turns, two turns to start on the new improvement, but it also puts one worker turn into a road that you'll eventually need at no downside because the worker spent the exact same amount of time doing it. If you are willing to micro your workers to this extent, you can save some time building your road network by avoiding wasting the turn in movement. And there's more options for doing it when you have a fast worker because they've got three, and then you can do things like move on to a hill tile and start building a mine on the same turn if you start adjacent to it. So the alternative would be, you know, moving one tile to get adjacent to the hill, starting on a road, and then on the next turn, moving onto the hill and starting your mine, etc. If that's the way you play, go for it. If you want to finish your game in under 6 hours, I don't think it makes that big of a difference. What do you guys think?
It can. It really can. There's been a couple times throughout my Civ playing experience where I really actually bothered to do it. And by bothering, I mean that I sat and I redid, like I made a test save and tried out a couple different worker micro aspects, planned out like the next 10, 20 turns or whatever, and it's impressive. Not only are you forced into your worker tech choices or your worker movement choices, but also just when to build them so that you have enough workers to not work on improved tiles, and then your tech choices as well to fall into place with improving this. And all of a sudden, you're hundreds of yields ahead by, like, turn 50. It's impressive what you can do if you plan it out. Now, let me say this. There is a reason you do not see very many of these kinds of videos on YouTube. I did a YouTube video where in Hall of Fame Challenge, I think it was one of the Challenge 5 games, where I actually put some time into the Cinderella game and did it out loud and cast it and posted it. And I had quite a few comments already that people just couldn't get into that much micro in the early game. Nothing was happening. You know, and then half hour's gone by and I'm not even at 2500 or 2000 BC or something because I'm planning out worker turns and doing these little road micro things. And it's amazing. It's hard to come up with good commentary while you're doing that. And I think that for the crowd that enjoys that kind of micro, a video isn't really appropriate. Because no matter what, if you're doing that kind of planning, you need to do the math. And if you need to do the math, you don't need to tell me, you don't need me to tell you or to show you how to do arithmetic. Most of my viewers, I would suspect, know arithmetic and probably much beyond that, certainly. So it's
one of those situations
where
can be really
you're willing to put the time in, then do it. Oh, yeah. And you can spend hours. I think unconquered.
Like you bring three workers to a new city that has, say, corn and gold, and you want to hook up the gold, and obviously the corn's good for growing the city. Sometimes the optimal way to do it is to move one worker onto the gold and start building a road while the other two start on the corn, so that when that road finishes, they can both move onto the hill without consuming a full worker turn and all start on the mine together, etc. Sometimes whether the hill is desert or plains makes a difference because it takes three turns to build a road on desert and it takes two and blah, 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 blah. This is some really crazy making stuff. It's a very deep rabbit hole.
people will spend 20 to 60 hours on D&D games sometimes. I've seen them. I've seen winning submissions with like 68 hours playtime. And, you know, not all the people who put those saves on the forum have spent like, you know, a day of that time just wandering around and doing laundry or whatever. And there's people who really put that much time into actually playing one game. So, you know, to someone who spends less than 3 on a typical basis, that's, you know, but 20 times as many hours is pretty impressive, and it, you can get results from it. If it's worth it to you, if you enjoy that, if that's fun, then absolutely do it. But hopefully you guys understand why there aren't a lot of videos of this material, because the vast majority of that work is not gameplay. It's planning and then doing a relatively short period of time actually making the moves and then going back and planning again. You get better results. I absolutely do.
Maybe that's why this thread exists. This OP Peanut.
Yeah,
he's like,
maybe.
I thought everybody knew this, but apparently people don't. and if we do, we just don't do it, is the thing.
Yes.
Although apparently this was new information to some of the people who commented in the thread. Oh, I'd never thought about that. Yeah, you can get more out of your workers by doing this. And yes, now that you've thought about it, you have entered a whole new world of micro that you may regret stepping into.
Yes. Yes, although it's good to know it's possible in a game, because that really opens your eyes to whether or not you want to get into that kind of depth and whatever. And, you know, just seeing that other people can do something, it lets you try and take steps to match it, and that does improve you as a player much more quickly than you would if you just were to play casually and not think about how to improve. That's true for any game. It's certainly true in Civ, but if you were trying to get better at any game, matching what the top players do and then trying to build on that once you understand what they do and why is one of the fastest ways to get to an elite level.
And when you were talking about you have to decide whether or not that's right for you, absolutely. You have to decide that the time that I'm going to take to put into this, am I going to be satisfied with not only the game, but satisfied that this extra time, you know, that I was playing the game and microing my workers this way, I could have been spending time with my family. Okay, no, actually, this is a good idea, then you decide. And that may very well, be what you get to.
Dan, you're being silly. What you're comparing it to is additional Civ games. Come on.
Yeah.
But actually, when it comes to this kind of micro, I'm more inclined to try my hand at it, not all the time, but from time to time in Civilization V. Partially because of only the one unit per tile not being able to stack workers, but at the same time, it's also limited because you have to take into account not only the fact, for instance, that you do not have to put a road on an improved tile in order to gain access to that luxury or that strategic resource, but also the road maintenance. But I find that because of one unit per tile, I don't have as many units on the map, which includes workers. I'm more likely to give them that TLC, especially if I'm deciding, okay, my city, you know, two of my cities have grown to a significant point that I want to be able to connect them for that trade network, or I just want to be able to connect the cities because I'm in the process of trying a military campaign, or I'm building up for one, or I'm in a rest period between the two, and I want to be able to get units to the front that much more quickly. But I think for those of us who really aren't super micro crazy, if you wanted to say, okay, I want to try my attempt at micro, I think you may get more out of it doing that in Civilization V as opposed to Civilization IV and sticking with the stacked workers in Civ IV.
Improvement maintenance gives you an additional reason to do it, because until a road has established a trade network, the maintenance you pay on it is wasted money. So if you can arrange to have the road that connects the cities crop up more quickly, that's going to benefit you in terms of money.
Not only that, one unit per tile has benefits and drawbacks when it comes to the micro-planning difficulty. Because you can't stack workers, you can't speed up an improvement on any one tile, and you have to plan for that. You also can't land a worker on the same tile that another worker is on, so you have to plan for that. And so you have to think about these things if you really want to optimize it even so. Is it less complex than Civ IV? I'm leaning toward probably, but I don't want to say it's significantly less complex. If you really want to maximize your output, you're probably going to still wind up putting a lot of time in. Now, Civ V is a little different in that a lot of what allows you to do well is more at the strategic level anyway, but certainly that fine worker micro is still there if you want it.
I automate my workers in Civ 5 fairly early.
That's pretty bad.
Civ 4 is
that in any Civ game? All Civ games where you can auto workers are terrible. Like, that's a terrible option. It might be better in Civ 5 than 4, but it's still not good.
No.
The thing about it is, if I can spend less time and still win on Immortal with automated workers, guess what I'm going to do?
Okay, fine.
No, it's an automation of workers better in Civ 4 than Civ 5.
No way. Yes. No way. Workers will, if you set them to auto on Civ 4 and you declare war on somebody, they will decide that it's a good time to move directly adjacent to enemy borders, literally touching the borders one tile away, and start improving a tile there, trapping themselves. I have bought 12 workers in Civ 4 this way in a single game. I don't see how Civ 5 could possibly be worse than that.
I'm not saying it was a good idea in Civ 4.
How do you do worse than worker suicide? Your worker commit suicide in Civ 4. What do they do in Civ 5 that's worse? Do they like
to leave their
avoid that against your will?
Other than not automating them. It turns out that they're suiciding into enemy territory or barbarians is a consequence of using the minimize pop-ups game option. Apparently they have a hit pop-up that warns them of danger and cancels their orders. And if you use the minimize pop-ups game option, they'll complete their orders rather than stopping. I'm not kidding. I was pretty upset when I discovered.
You still learn new things every day. Oh my god. Fail axis. I was starting to get on their good side. They were getting on my good side again with this XCOM thing. And then I hear something like this, and it's facepalm. Really? Game option literally screws you because you check it. Not to mention that this is a mandatory option in simultaneous turns multiplayer if it's competitive. There is no way you will survive well if you leave that off. You will get double moved to hell.
If you want
to
do a fast game in single player, you got to use it too.
Yeah, you do.
I continue to use it even after having discovered this because I flirted with not using it for a little while. Like, you know what? Screw this.
Frustrating. It is so much faster to play with that on. But wow, I did not know that. That is a very interesting tip.
The reason that I said that I think that Civ 4 automated workers are better than Civ 5 is because with Civ 4, and when I'm talking about automating workers, I'm talking about one automation function only, which if I call correctly, wasn't always in Civ 4. Either one of the expansions or one of the expansions patches introduced it, which was the improved trade network. Yeah, the suicide issue is still there. Grant that, and I didn't know about the pop-up window thing either. I thought that was just a given, but I must have that checked and never even thought about the connection. But improving the trade network, of course, is not something that I would be interested in telling my workers to do in Civ 5. No, I don't want you to put roads everywhere. Not only is it not necessary, but it's going to cost me freaking maintenance. I don't want that option. But at least in Civ 4, by the time I'm to the point where, okay, for the most part, I want to automate my workers, I've got so many already that, you know, and the thing is, yes, the units, they can go in and they can kill those workers, but sometimes, especially with the AI, that can actually be an advantage, right? Because you can get them to, hey, here, go after my worker instead of my military unit so I can attack you first or I can get that unit out of the way. But that's the reason why I was saying that I feel that Civ 4 automated workers are better than Civ 5.
That felt extreme. I don't do that anymore.
And with Civ 5 workers, actually, with any worker, if you disband that worker within your territory, you get, I mean, yes, I know with Civ 5, you can see that, oh, I'm getting more gold per turn, potentially because you're not having as much on unit maintenance. But if you disband a worker or any unit within your territory, you do get a little bit of gold instantaneously. Not a lot, but you know how important Civ 5 gold is.
Everybody's favorite thing to say right before we declare war. You're right to worry. It's time for you to die. Oh, Titanium, very cute play on words in that username, started a topic over on Sifanatics. Well, that was the title of it, actually. He says he's been through this message a lot. Many times he's declared war on them from this, or you lied and declare war on them later. He wants to know, would there be a way to tell them beforehand, I'm going to declare a war on you, but hang on a sec, I'm not quite ready. Which kind of seems counterproductive to me. Because that would, when if they had that in game, wouldn't that flag the AI to suddenly start prioritize building units? Or buying them? Or Are you trying to make it more? Let's think about it. If you did that in multiplayer, I'm not going to declare war you just yet, but give me 10 turns.
My hands are full right now.
Yeah. I've too much on my hands right now.
That happens. Well, it doesn't happen the way you're breaking it down, but in multiplayer, people like to sign these non-aggression pacts, and then you have the option to do them at, say, turn 70 or turn 90 or whatever it is, and someone person will come up and ask, hey, you want to turn to the non-aggression pact? And the other one's like, no, that doesn't work for me at this time. Gee, I wonder what the implications of this are.
What you want to do is you want to keep many of your troops not near a border of an AI as possible. Now, yes, mainly with the one unit per turn, and depending upon what it is that you're trying to do, are you trying to take a city? Are you just trying to take out, units to start with? So, you know, you move in your melee units to the front, and you got your siege in the back. It's catapult, it's archer, if it's early game, whatever it happens to be. To minimize the likelihood that you are actually going to get that notification. And sometimes I actually do find that to be really sensitive. My favorite is actually when you have a unit stationed, say, healing, and then the AI plonks a city right down beside that unit you're healing, and then the next turn, I see your units amassing at my border.
Find that wounded scout really threatening, do you?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just like, oh, come on. So now I'm going to get the diplomat for that?
And I noticed further down the post, because he's worried about the diplo penalty for that, you're going to war. Of course you're going to get a diplo penalty either way. You know, because the whole thing...
The other AI.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. Because,
Well, you get an additional diplo penalty for breaking your word, though. And that's what you're trying to get away from.
Yes. So station your units just a little further away so that doesn't pop up.
Yeah, yes.
He wants to be able to unilaterally invade other countries without the rest of the world thinking that he's a warmonger.
But do they still get pissy with you if they come upon your military, even if it's nowhere near their borders, just if they have a unit near it? Or has that been sorted out at least?
It's not all of the time, so I wonder if it has to do with the AI personality. I haven't exactly looked at the code for that. But the thing that I don't like about that is the extra sensitivity part. Like, it should be able to recognize all of a sudden this last turn there has been an X number increase in units along borders of one or more of my cities and then give that response. So that way, as Mackie was saying, of course you're going to get what do you care about that diplomat if you're about to declare war? But if you're not interested in doing that and it just happens to be, or even, you know, like you're exploring, you didn't even know that they were there, you move the unit or two beside them and then you get that notification, I see you there. You know, hiding in the shadows, you're just going to declare war or what? You say, no, I don't. I mean, the other alternative, of course, is, right, you know, to say, no, my units are just merely passing through the area, opposed to then saying, no, you're right to worry and it's time for you to die. Taking that option as it is as well, if you say that, then you've declared, but you aren't going to get the first strike opportunity necessarily now. So I never choose that option.
Yeah. The OP seems to be saying he wants a third option that says, yes, I am going to invade you, but I'm not ready to do so yet, so please don't attack me.
It doesn't work like that. The Germans roll up to the border of Poland and say, hey, guys, can you wait a couple months, then we're going to invade you, okay?
I like Ford's response. I don't even really think a third option is certainly not necessary, and I don't even know about desirable, but he suggests that a possible answer could be, I'll station my troops where I please.
That's a good one.
Yeah, actually, I mean, the AI is really bossy. They're always like, you know, you're settling cities near us. I covet lands that you own, you know. You can't station your own troops in your own borders where you please. Am I sovereign or not? What's going on here?
You're trying to win the game in a similar method.
I was going to break that one up.
That was required to say. That has to. Every single time we talk about diplomacy in Civ 5, we have to bring that up. That's required. Until if and when it is removed.
There's all. Why are you trying to win my way?
In December, early December to early January, we asked for your feedback, the Polycast audience, on 10 different questions, the survey which was powered by SurveyMonkey. One thing that we've done in this episode, is try to balance Civilization 4 and Civilization 5 topics. Sometimes it's mostly Civ 4 or all Civ 4 or mostly Civ 5 or all Civ 5. So because of that, out of all of the questions, I figured, you know, try to make a segue between what we have been talking about and this one to make it sound like we actually have a plan for these things that we record. The fourth question was that balancing this coverage, as well as the Civ series in general, is an ongoing effort on Polycast. What do you feel that balance should be in 2012? Now, this survey had 59 responses. Two of the responses talked about Civ 4 coverage primarily, and two of them talked about Civ 5 coverage primarily, or even the Civ series in general. So taking those two values together, Civ 5 primarily had 27 votes. Civ 4 primarily had 25. So it's a bit of a wash as far as I'm concerned. So to me, we just be continuing to do what we have been doing, which is balancing Civ 4 and Civ 5 to come out with an average, which is really sort of what we were doing last year. Is anybody surprised by this result? I know I wasn't.
Not really.
Not particularly, no.
Let's go back to a bit to the beginning, because there are a few questions that I want to talk a little bit more about than not. The first question was, in 2011, Polycast switched its recording format from pre-recorded to live. Which format do you prefer? If you listen to episode 137, released 1 week ago as of this recording, I kind of indirectly answered whether or not we would be sticking with the live format or going back to pre-recorded. And the answer is, of course, that we're sticking with the live format. Of the 59 votes, however, live received 30 responses, and pre-recorded got 29, which did surprise me. We can't know for certain, of course, but I think part of that might be to our audience to note that when we switched from pre-recorded to live, the post-production changed on my part a fair bit. You hear a lot of more of ums and ahs and ers. I still get rid of the maybe a's. I get rid of a lot of lulls. I got rid of a lot of the awkward silences still, but it's not as polished as it used to be in that respect. And that people saying and or you know and like over an hour of broadcast does add up. So that response did surprise me, but that may be the reason why. I know there are pros and cons to having the live or the pre-recorded format, but I think on the whole that live for us at this point in the show's history is the better way to go. I'm not saying that all podcasts should be live or all pre-recorded.
Live is awesome. always live? At risk of saying something completely inappropriate and causing immense grief, and that pressure is an amazing feeling.
Yeah, like right now, I'm trying not to make a comment.
Yep.
I really love the post-production end result that we used to have in the pre-recorded format. But this real life with family and friends and job just...
Yeah, it's a real drag, isn't it?
All of that really interferes with my Polycast post-production time. It's a real pain. But just practically, not only to be able to edit the episodes, but to be able to edit the episodes in a timely fashion, that was the other problem, especially when Civ 5 was released in September, October 2010. We were recording episodes, and then I had to rejig the recording order was changed when it came to releasing the episodes, and it was 2 or 3 weeks behind, and it was difficult to talk about up-and-coming news things, and I have to scrap a whole bunch of something, because with news especially, it's not something that you can even save for later. It doesn't have the same impact. So it was really for practical reasons that went to the live format. But I'm also liking at least the opportunity of the live format. Hopefully we'll get some more live listeners this year. And one of the things that we're going to be doing, actually, I'll mention it here, is Polycast actually does have a Twitter account now at the Polycast. So going to try to, you know, post messages there to say, hey, a new episode has been released, or we're going to start recording live in an hour. Those kind of things to increase the interactivity, and also actually mention on the recording that we record every other Saturday, and the next episode recording will be on January 28th over at thepolycast.net. The second question had to do with how long our episodes were. We went to 60-minute episodes last year in addition to going live, rather than having 45-minute episodes, and 29 people said that, yes, we want the 60-minute episodes to continue. The next closest was actually 45 minutes with 13 responses, and the others were either under 30 minutes or 30 minutes or 75 minutes or greater than 75 minutes, of which six people wanted more than 75-minute post-produced episodes.
What?
They really, really love us. We appreciate that.
It's that very long car trip.
I was about to say.
Was that the first time you announced the Polycast Twitter? Because as of right now, I'm your only follower.
That's me.
That was the first time I announced it, yes, and it will be in the show notes. But yay, we have a follower! Woohoo!
Yes.
Yes.
We will one day have more followers than Obama's wife. Probably not, actually.
She has 21,482 followers.
She just started, like, a week ago.
So we only have 21,481 to go? That's no problem.
Yeah, I know. Our rate will catch up very soon, I assure you.
I mean, you know, it might be 2075, but, you know, we'll catch up. It's fine.
Before you know it, we'll be ahead of Katy Perry, too.
Just to reiterate, the Twitter account name is The Polycast. Question number three. Polycast records episodes on a biweekly basis. This has always been the case, and 39 of the 59 agreed with us that we should continue to do that, although the next most popular response was weekly at 14. I don't think we could fake liking each other that much, honestly. Oh, God.
I could do an episode every weekend, but the quality I could not assure would remain the same as it is at present.
Although that's never really been a concern of ours, so I don't know.
Quality? What is this?
Okay, yeah.
That aside.
We kid, people, we kid.
Monthly got 6 votes, but nobody wanted it to be quarterly, so. Talked about question number 4. Question number 5. This was interesting, and I know Phil and I in particular talked about this shortly after the poll was launched. Listed the segment names, which in hindsight, I wish I'd given a brief description, in part because if you just listen to the episode, you probably don't realize what the segments are called because we don't say that anymore. We don't even have a summary at the start of the show anymore. You would only see that if you're really paying attention to the topics list off our website, the RSS feed, whatever it happens to be. But Forum Talk got 53 of 59 votes, which is where we talk about hot topics in the forums, which, okay, that didn't surprise me. But the fact that we are a strategy podcast, a Civ Strategy podcast, and our Civ Strategy specific segment is Senate, only got 36 out of 59, led me to start to believe that people didn't equate Senate with strategy, which if you're talking about real life, you know I understand that. This is gameplay, people. Gameplay.
For example, the majority of the topics covered on the show today were Senate, so I had some reservations about trusting the outcome of this particular poll result without a very clear explanation on it, certainly.
Other than Senate, those receiving more than 30 votes included community focus. So this is where we looked at We Play Civ and Civ Players last year specifically. It's like an interview, only we're talking about the community rather than the person. Miscellaneous also got 30, kind of the catch-all. Open Mic, of which this is, by the way. There's actually one mistake in my question that I didn't even realize till towards the end, and nobody called me on it, so I'll call myself on it. Time Machine was included on this list, which is fine, which is where we look back at Civ history, except I said in Statement 5 that these segments were included in one or more episodes of Polycast in 2011, and there was never a Time Machine segment in 2011. Oops. That also received more than 30 votes. Receiving more than 40 votes was Interview, news. That kind of surprised me. Although now that we record live and we have a one-week turnover time, we haven't seen that since, or even less since season one. So that makes news more practical now. But that still surprised me, along with Research Lab, which is things that could be in Civ, but are not yet, but maybe in the future. I think it's worth noting that the segment that got the least amount of votes with 23 was the theater, where we talk about our Civ games. Fair enough, we didn't do that very much. I was actually surprised we got as many votes as we did for that. The next three had to do with rating Polycast on a particular measure. Passion was one, being excited about what you have to say. 18 of 59, and this was the most popular response, gave us a 7 out of 10. Thank you. Followed by 9, superb at 13, and excellent at 8. So I guess we're doing well, at least according to these 59 people, or at least according to these 59 votes. Having dialogue, which is connecting with our audience, 15 said excellent. That was the most popular response, followed by 6 with 13, and 9 people said it was superb. So comparable. And then there was our professional measure.
Wait, what?
where having organization on a podcast has been described as professional, and I just left it at that. And believe it or not, there was a tie, and no, it wasn't between 1 and 2. It was between 7 and 8, with 16 votes apiece, followed by Superb at 9. So, oh man, we really bluff you people. Well, no, wait. Moving on.
We'll see if you still vote that way after I added the passion of the show.
Finally, I'm saving the throwdown, topic to last, because it was also the last question asked. The last two questions had to do with personalities, real or fake, where we asked which guest co-hosts you would like to see return in 2012 based on those that appeared on one or more episodes 2011. And I can tell you that there was at least one vote, and actually more than that, for everybody on the list. But in terms of specifics, I've just mentioned those that got 20 votes or more and those that got 30 votes or more. Those who got more than 20 were Bibor, Canuck Soldier, K-Mad Candy, and Locutus, and two of those being past regular co-hosts on the show. And those that received more than 30 votes, there wasn't anybody that received more than 40 or 50. There was actually a tie for the most requested guest. That was 37 votes for Majin and 37 votes for Sula. Congrats to both of you for whatever that is worth. Now, that was funny timing because Majin just said in the chat, no one likes me.
apparently, actually, they do.
And then, of course, the who is your favorite regular co-host on Polycast? Congratulations, too, with 23 votes or 39%. Congrats, the Mian team.
He won New Hampshire.
Self-voting, I love you. Oh, wait. I actually didn't, but I thank you guys. Gives me a warm feeling.
Well, I think it's because he does a lot of our strategy talking, which is what a lot of people, I think, are listening for.
Yeah, you beat me by 5 votes, Phil. Darn you.
Close. It's because of the passion, Dan. I showcase passion.
He showcases more facepalm than I do sometimes.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
I got a 50% raise this year. I'm happy. For Polycast, that is.
Oh. 50% of nothing, what?
Pretty much. Details, Mac P. Drink more coffee, and you'll be excited about your 50% raise also.
Actually, Mackie got more than that, but she was just not wanting to say. She was trying to be, you know, sensitive to your feelings. But,
I got 75% of nothing.
Wait, what? Why would you be sensitive to my feelings? I don't understand.
Phil's so familiar with this whole being nice thing.
This has been Polycast episode 138, and we've been joined by our guest co-host, Ismir Singer.
Thanks for having me.
Our regular co-host, Dan Q.
Walking through the money tree forest.
Makalua.
I'm looking for more time units because I'm out and there's an alien in front of me. Oh, God.
The me and team.
All of my impressions are lasting ones.
And me. To it all. Have a good one, everyone.
He's a little Clockwork Orange.
I was just thinking of the eyeball opener thing, so he can't blink. Yeah.
Exactly.
Good enough. Continue on.
Yes, continue.
Oh, was this my topic? I didn't.
Yeah. Thanks for paying attention to this. The itinerary.
And much more importantly, I-based T-Suite in the XML specifically. AIs that have...
Oh, you cut out there, Phil. Oh, you got cut out completely, actually. Awkward silence was required there for just a few moments.
Record date, January 14th, 2012. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips. Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.